This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 5th of April, 2010, and I'm honored to be joined on the line by Barry Zwicker, a journalist, media critic, documentary filmmaker, public speaker, and author of one of the seminal works of 9/11 literature, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. Barry Zwicker, thank you so much for joining me again today on The Corbett Report.
It's truly a pleasure, James. Truly a pleasure.
Well, Mr. Zwicker, as anyone who knows about yourself and your work would know, you were the first person in the world to go on national TV and really begin to deeply question the events of 9/11 and to really start asking the questions that no other media outlet or personality was asking at that time. And you, it seems, I'm not sure if this is fair to say this, but it seems that you pretty much from day one were questioning those events and the way they were being portrayed. And certainly you were raising very, very troubling questions about the early stages of the official story. So I guess I'd like to start our conversation today by asking you, what were some of the first signs that you had that there was something untoward about the way in which these events were being portrayed to us, and what were some of those key signs that made you begin questioning the events of 9/11?
Yes, the key aspect of 9/11, and I don't know whether to pat myself on the back or whether that would be a sign of ego. I don't think so. I don't know what it's by virtue of. Exactly why I have a suspicious or a critical or a skeptical mind, but I always have had from the time, you know, I was around 12 years old. I was questioning things, and partly due to my upbringing. The second thing is that my father, a Protestant clergyman of the progressive side, had been very much opposed to Hitler. And even at a time when Hitler was being mollycoddled by the likes of Time magazine and Reader's Digest and so forth, and my father later joined the Royal Canadian Air Force and came out as a squadron leader, and I knew about the Reichstag fire, which a lot of people didn't, and a lot of people still don't know, where the German Parliament was burned down in late February 1933. And to make a long story short, that fire was set by the Nazis, and yet it was blamed on the communists. And the communists and the socialists, in other words, the conscious left, were the main impediment to Hitler's march to power in Germany. And so I knew that a large event could be trumped up like a huge magic trick. That was already in my mind, and I do believe that helped. But what really immediately, and I did twig to 9/11 being extremely fishy before noon on that day, was the fact that no U.S. jet interceptor turned a wheel until it was too late. And I had this long-standing and interest in aviation. I joined the Royal Canadian Air Cadets and became a flight sergeant, and I went to a flying school one summer and flew a Twin Beach. And I've always really, really been interested in aviation, and I knew that the U.S. Air Force was the most powerful, technological, superior Air Force that ever has existed on the face of the planet. And so on the morning of 9/11, if you recall, there were reports of multiple airliners going in their errant ways. So I was in the living room watching this TV along with millions of others. But what I was doing was I was shouting, "Come on, U.S. Air Force. Come on, U.S. Air Force." I was very, very anxious the U.S. Air Force would come into play. I believed at that time that, as the CNN crawl had it, that America was under attack. I accepted that framework. And so I thought, where's the Air Force? And this went on and on. It was almost 2 hours, you may recall, that nothing happened to prevent the planes hitting the World Trade Center towers. and then nothing happened to prevent the plane allegedly hitting the Pentagon, and nothing happened regarding, as we understood it then, regarding the other plane that allegedly crashed in Pennsylvania. We know all these so-called facts now weren't facts necessarily at all. So that's why I just had a huge suspicion about it. That was my entree into it.
Right, exactly. And I think those were the starting points for a lot of people when they were beginning to question these events. And as you say, a lot of those facts, as we were being giving them, are now no longer taken to be facts. So I guess as the story began to be deconstructed, a lot of those early suspicions proved to be very prescient, I think, in the ways that the official story was deconstructed, to the point where, of course, the 9/11 Commission itself had even considered bringing charges against members of the Pentagon who had been deliberately misleading the 9/11 Commission about the timeline of that day, and they were even considering criminal charges against members of the Pentagon, and that were trying to describe the way that the U.S. Air Force was non-reacting to those events, and I think that's one of the key aspects of that day. But of course, there are many, many, many others. So I guess today I wanted to break down some of the examples of actions that you think, at least from our perspective at this point, several years on, are indicative of a cover-up, and what ways we can categorize those actions that may have participated or in some way furthered that cover-up, from destruction of evidence or intimidation of witnesses or things along those lines.
Well, because I'm writing a book about false flag operations in history, I've been trying to stand back and look at the subject of false flag operations generically, if you will, trying to see them conceptually. And so it seems to me that looking at false flag operations, and if in case there are some listeners who are unfamiliar with the term, which is fortunately becoming more and more known and understood, but the term relates to immediately here in what we're talking about, it relates to an event which is portrayed to be caused by some enemy, some designated enemy. But in fact, the event is perpetrated by the rulers or the government of the country allegedly under attack. That is your classic false flag operation. And so 9/11 was probably the greatest example in history of that. I should say that that it helps, at least it helps me conceptually, to because there are many definitional issues when we look at these deceptions. There's so many kinds of deceptions perpetrated for so many different reasons, but it helps me conceptually to see that there are at least three kinds of false flag operation. That is, there are false flag operators. This would be your spies and your undercover agents, your moles, who are not what they present themselves as. Your CIA agents all over the world, and they're coming across as business people or your friends or leaders of peace organizations or whatever, and they're not. They're false flag operators. Then the second thing you have is false flag organizations, or you might call front organizations. During the McCarthy era, the America was alive with paranoia about communist false front organizations, or front organizations. Allegedly, labor unions were communist infiltrated, which would make them a front organization, portraying themselves as just a nice labor organization, but really, really run by the demonic commies. So that's your false front organizations. And then you have your false flag events. So there are three kinds of false flag: agents, or individuals, organizations, and events. So we're mainly talking about events here, but we'll find that they all blend. They all blend finally when it comes to the cover-up. So then, as to an event, it again has three stages, chronologically and simplistically speaking. One is the planning stage, two is the execution stage, and three is the cover-up stage. And the cover-up is the most important and the most extensive, of course. But these three stages overlap. So let me explain. If you take them one by one, the planning stage is carried out in ultra secrecy. Now, there's very little chance, if any, of the planners or their plans being exposed because they're operating in the deep shadows. Although later on, we can discuss how honest and patriotic citizens can sometimes stand a chance of exposing false flag operations or planned ones before they're actually mounted. But anyway, we'll come to that. So the planning is the first stage, ultra secret. The execution is also ultra secret. Generally, the execution is an unopposed military operation. If you look at 9/11, the Air Force was involved, civil aviation, radar, I mean, the you know, Homeland Security, the FBI, all sorts of government and non-government and quasi-governmental organizations, covert and overt, are involved in the execution. It's really a military operation, and nobody opposes it. And then the cover-up stage that follows is also controlled by the perpetrators of the planning and the execution. And so the cover-up is vast. I would say it's encompassing institutionally. It involves the obedient mainstream corporate media and also the heavily infiltrated so-called alternative media. It involves a large number of government organizations, the FBI, for instance, and quasi and non-government organizations. NIST would be a great example. It involves the judiciary and the scores of moles and operatives situated at all sorts of points of influence throughout society, you know, such as public intellectuals, the gatekeepers of the left, whose job is to control the opposition to the perpetrators who would plan and execute and be covering up a vast toxic event like 9/11. The judiciary, we've already been treated to a series of show trials regarding the so-called war on terror, and these show trials will continue and I predict become ever higher in profile as we move toward the crescendo of cover-up and propaganda that will surround the 10th anniversary of 9/11 in a year from September. It was an American social critic, his last name is Ray, I think, who said, "Anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power." And you just have to think of how Pearl Harbor is memorialized every year, so many years after it happened, to see the power of anniversaries. But to say more about the cover-up and the reason that when you get more deeply into it, you can't talk about the cover-up as a separate phenomenon. We've noted already that the cover-up is already being planned for in the planning stages for the false flag event. And then the false flag event itself is, by definition, its own cover-up. I mean, otherwise we'd be talking about naked aggression, which is not unknown, of course. But we're not talking about naked aggression. We're talking about a false flag operation, a clothed aggression, if you will. And just by way of distinguishing between let us say lies and false flag operations, that systemic lying that emanated from the White House and 10 Downing Street prior to the war on Iraq, in which it was held that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. Now, those lies do not qualify as a false flag operation. I mean, even at the time, the lies were seen by a small number of alert citizens as being lies, or at least as being highly suspicious. even if they were emanating from the New York Times, especially courtesy of Judith Miller, a dependable mouthpiece for the deep state. She's no longer with the Times. And I devoted a good part of a chapter in my book, Towers of Deception, that you kindly mentioned, to Judith Miller as being complicit in the cover-up of 9/11. And she was complicit in the lies told to justify that Iraq war. And frankly, by the way, I was surprised that the U.S. deep state didn't plant WMDs in Iraq that would then be prominently found and paraded before the world as supposedly undeniable proof of Iraq's war-making capabilities and intentions. Now, the supposed actual finding of supposedly actual Iraqi nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, that would be a false flag op. It would be on a par with the supposed dead incubator babies that were allegedly found in a Kuwaiti hospital, allegedly left behind by Iraqi soldiers on the cold concrete floor to die, and whose alleged dead existence was used as a key justification for that 1991 attack on Iraq. So we see that a false flag op, then the cover-up is arguably the most important aspect of a false flag op, and that it starts off wearing its own cover, and then there needs to be a further cover-up, which is maybe really what your question was about, to cover up the magic trick, the holes in the story, the anomalies and contradictions and absurdities of the official conspiracy theory that's trotted out for public consumption. And so the very story itself, of course, is a cover-up, and then they have to cover up the aspects of the cover-up that don't add up. So it's really remarkable. I think very few people appreciate or grasp how many operatives are involved in a cover-up, or how sophisticated and continuous and interleaved it is. And so that also reminds me of something that you and I were talking about before we started recording, and which I hope we'll come to, is the presence of agents of the state in, for instance, anti-war or peace organizations, who then use their influence to prevent or control that peace organization, that anti-war organization, from looking into the nuts and bolts of the state-sponsored false flag terror fraud. And that's a very important part of the cover-up. Because as I mentioned regarding Germany in the 1930s, you have to look at the different components of society. And the Germany of the 1930s, if you were to ask the question, who opposed Hitler and attempted to break down the various components of German society at that time and ask that question, it's surprising what you come up with. For instance, did the Roman Catholic Church oppose Hitler? The answer is no. Did the Protestant churches oppose Hitler? With rare exceptions like Pastor Niemöller, the answer is no. Did the labor unions and trade unions oppose Hitler? Not much. Did the farmers oppose Hitler? No, hardly at all. Did the army oppose Hitler? No. Did the aristocracy oppose Hitler? No, actually, the women in the aristocracy sold their jewels to help to fund the Nazi Party, and they used their homes for Nazi Party meetings. Did the civil service oppose Hitler? No, they didn't. Did the judiciary? Not. No. What about the medical profession? What about the universities? The intellectuals in general? No, none of them opposed Hitler in any serious way. The only opposition to Hitler was from the conscious left. And you know what? The people who operate the deep state know that. they know if I would be proud to characterize myself as a member of the conscious left, they know that we are their most effective opposition, because we ask questions, because we're skeptical, because we're proud to dissent as part of our democratic heritage, because we are willing to oppose, because we are willing to blow the whistle, because we are willing to, as they say, speak truth to power. And so that is why we are a serious enemy of a deep state. And that is why it's very relevant to discuss agents of the deep state in our midst, who then do all they can to defang us. I don't have to answer that, by the way. Another phone.
All right. Well, there are a number of very interesting points that you raised there that I could pick up on, but I think one of the things that I'd like to consider is the idea of people who are involved in the cover-up. As you say, there must be a number of false flag operators who are actively involved in covering up the event itself, but I guess one of the questions that are raised in this discussion is, are the people who are involved in the cover-up necessarily consciously aware that the steps they are taking is a part of the cover-up?
A very good question. I mean, the short answer has to be no. There are many there are many actors in this world, and Shakespeare said all the world's a stage, and we're all players. And also, before we started recording this conversation, I was saying to you, I don't know whether the term is embarrassed. I'm not sure what term to use. At how little I know, how ignorant I am on so many subjects. And I sometimes ask myself, why is it 8 years after 9/11 that I'm just twigging, just getting wise to some new aspect of the cover-up that I hadn't seen before, and or some clarification that's needed about how the deep state works, and therefore how we can try to offset, you know, and push back against the deep state. So there, if you almost could look at it philosophically, to say that none of us, and I guess it also could be looked at in theological terms, none of us are free of sin. So none of us are free of ignorance, which is not such a moralistic term as sin. We're all ignorant. In fact, I would claim that I'm mainly ignorant of what goes on in the world, even at my advanced age. I maybe possess some small pools of knowledge here and there, but basically I have everything. I have so much to learn. Not everything, but so much. And so, why would I think that other people would be different? So that I would also add to that my experience of decades in the mainstream media. I mean, I worked for large daily newspapers for years, for about 17 years. I was a daily newspaper reporter. And looking back on it, I realized that I was, if you will, an intellectual cog in an economic wheel. And I didn't realize the role I was playing. Maybe just sometimes would have some idea of that. And so that obviously there are people in all sorts of institutions, and maybe you can clarify, James, more specifically what you're thinking of when you ask the question. But there would be people in all sorts of institutions who would be carrying out their job, not realizing really the true dimensions of what they're about. Did you have a more specific example in mind?
Well, I wanted to get your take on it in a general sense, but I think the things that would occur to me along that line is something like people in the media, people, journalists who are repeating the line that has been officially formed about the official story of the conspiracy theory of 9/11, but without necessarily consciously being aware that they are participating in the cover-up of the real truth by thus dismissing relevant facts and arguing for a line that has been fed from somewhere else.
There are absolutely people, and because I've met people that I like, I know, I respect, they don't get it. And they're in the media, and there's others not in the media. And it comes back, if you will, to ignorance and evidence, and ignorance of evidence. And so that is key in understanding that people can be complicit without knowing it in a deadly machine. Currently, there's a series of 6 one-hour programs running on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's TV, and it's called Love, War, and Propaganda. And it's as they put it, it's World War II for a new generation. And of course, one thing they're looking at is how much did people know about the death camps where the Jews in Europe were being transported in boxcars to the death camps. And the series, even at 6 hours length, still doesn't really do much more than scratch the surface, I would say, of that period in history. They also deal with World War II. They deal with propaganda in the pre-war and in the wartime period. I don't know whether they're going to get to the post-war period. I actually doubt it. But the programs show that, for instance, the propaganda operation of Goebbels under Hitler was extremely sophisticated, and it absolutely fooled a lot of people. They went so far as to have a village, I forget the name of it, where a lot of Jews were sent, and the International Red Cross, that had suspicions there was something wrong, that Jews were being rounded up, that they were being hurt or whatever, killed, whatever the International Red Cross had suspicions about, it asked if it could send a representative to this particular village. I mean, this is apart from everything else that was going on at the time, and to see firsthand what's happening there. And what the Nazis managed to do was to create the appearance that the Jews in this village were happy. They did all sorts of things in order to give this appearance to the single guy. He was only in his late 20s. To this particular guy who was sent see the village. They had people who were, they had Jews who were well-dressed. They had them happy because they gave them new clothes and they gave them gifts. And so that these kids actually were happy. They'd been given gifts. They didn't know what lay in store for them either. They were later sent to Auschwitz. And so they were at sort of a holding station, which was a what the Russians call a Temkin village. It was all false front, if you will. This was a false flag operation, come to think of it. And so not only did they set up the village so that the people that were there were all happy, but he wasn't really allowed to talk to them. And then his route was carefully planned so that it would avoid all the other places in the village that weren't so hot, and where he wouldn't see people caged up in rooms being kept away from his chosen tour route. And he came away completely fooled. And the International Red Cross said, you know what, the Jews are being well treated. So you couldn't really blame people who would read the report of the International Red Cross findings for believing them. I mean, geez, it's a one-sided, you know, this is really a one-sided propaganda battle. Then you have, though, the deeper, more complicated question of partial complicity. In other words, there are things that we know, I say we, just thinking of human beings at large, There are things we know that we don't really want to think about. And some of these things they're painful. Maybe they're personally painful, or they're painful on our local scene or even worldwide. And so we don't want to think about them. We say, we don't want to hear bad news. Don't trouble me with that. Or these people deserve what they get. There's a whole lot of rationalizations that human beings can arrive at in order to actually become quite complicit in crimes that other people are carrying out. And so there's a whole continuum from being completely ignorant, and therefore, if you will, if you're completely ignorant, then you're really completely innocent. But then there are degrees of knowing, and degrees of knowing, you know, to go back to Rumsfeld's famous quote, which was quite an accurate and valid quote, by the way, about the things we know and the things we don't know and the things we know we don't know and so forth. He was quite right on that. And so the more we know specifically and allow ourselves to think about, if it's then a wrong that's being perpetrated and we take no action, then you come into the looking at complicity. And so when it comes to the media, you've got everything from total ignorance to full complicity. And I don't know if any of your listeners would have seen the video of that was shot at a conference in Philadelphia. It was the word treason was in the title of the conference. A TV interviewer from ABC went there, and I think his name is Chris Matthews. And
actually, it was Chris Burry.
Oh, was it Chris Burry? Thank you. And so then, obviously, you're familiar with that. And anybody who watches that, well, not anybody, but a lot of people who would watch that would get very angry at that Chris Burry, at how condescending he was and how slippery. And when he was interviewing Corey Rowe and who's the other guy from Loose Change?
Corey Rowe and Dylan Avery.
And Dylan Avery, yeah. And and Dylan Avery refused to shake his hand at the end, and I thought that was a legitimate thing for him to reject shaking that guy's hand. The guy was so obviously insincere and out to get them. It was a sandbagging operation, we call it, in journalism, and so there's a large number of paid CIA agents and assets within the media. That Charles Burry looks like one, you can't prove it, and there's a long history of that. I included some of that in my book, where long ago the CIA. A director of the CIA said, "We own everybody of any importance in the U.S. media," and there's a huge amount of documentation about it, but that tends to be forgotten because one reason being that there aren't enough people on the left who make an issue of agents, and that itself is an issue. Why is it that there hasn't been any kind of a thorough congressional inquiry into the operations of the CIA and the other 15 major intelligence agencies of the U.S. government, for that matter, since the Church Committee hearings of the mid-70s? How could all that time go by while these intelligence organizations are getting bigger and bigger and more sophisticated, more powerful, larger budgets, and yet they never get looked at? So that isn't just coincidence. I mean, there's a lot of failure of the kind we're talking about, of people to want to face the enormity of the damage that covert activities wreak upon society and the world. A lot of people don't want to look at that any more than they wanted to look at the Holocaust of the 30s and during the Hitler regime. And I maybe shouldn't put the two I didn't exactly equate them, and I don't mean to equate them, but the damage that's done by false flag operations run by false flag operators is huge. In fact, it does. It results in millions of deaths. It's killing us, and I think it's way overdue for every country to have a hard look at its so-called security forces, because they are probably the worst among the worst enemies of our security.
Well, that's absolutely right. And taking the discussion back specifically to 9/11, for the listeners who have not done an extensive amount of research on the operation or how it played out, I guess it would be perhaps helpful for listeners to think of some of the ways in which the cover-up specifically has worked on 9/11. And some of the things that come to mind when I think of this aspect, we can think of, obviously, the removal of the physical evidence from the crime scene at Ground Zero is one of the ones that has come up time and again when we discuss this subject. Also, things like the seizing of surveillance tapes around the Pentagon by the FBI, which happened almost immediately after whatever happened at the Pentagon happened. We have the destruction of FAA tapes, where one of the managers actually took and physically shredded some of the tapes that had been used to record some of the FAA employees who had given an oral testimony about what had happened that morning. Those tapes were actually taken, physically shredded, and deposited in separate garbage bins around the FAA complex. We have hindrance of fact-finding teams at Ground Zero. We have the various commissions and inquiries which were appointed in the wake of the events, and of course, 9/11, the 9/11 Commission itself not being appointed for over a year after the event itself, just an unthinkable amount of time. We have, obviously, the way the media has shaped the boundaries of dissent. We have so many different acts and aspects of this, but are there any others that stick out to you as really important ways in which this event has been covered up?
Well, the presence of covert agents on the left is, I think, more important than it's terrible in a way to have to try to have a hierarchy of importance in regards to a cover-up, but I think we need to attempt it. Now, for instance, you mention the fact that steel debris from the World Trade Center, which was all crime scene evidence, was transported away as fast as possible and put on freighters and shipped to China and India to be melted down as quickly as possible, made into paperclips or whatever. And so obviously that's cover-up. There are aspects of that cover-up that are further revealing. For instance, it required a special dock on the New York waterfront to accommodate these trucks that would trundle from Ground Zero with these lengths of steel, conveniently had been cut in the course of the collapse of the towers into approximately 30-foot lengths that would fit onto the trucks. And then it required the construction of a special dock in order to have these freighters cozy up to that and transport this steel on. So that would require a lot of pre-planning, and the very pre-planning of that itself would be extremely revealing. It's usually the cover-up that finally is what nabs criminals. You can see this in real life. I mean, Al Capone was finally nailed on income tax evasion, which is maybe a little to one side. But when people cover up, there has to be a reason why they're covering up, and in uncorrupted courts of law, and also in the ordinary experience of ordinary people, it's known that when something's being covered up, there's a reason, And generally the reason is that those conducting the cover-up were guilty of whatever it is that's being covered up. So the metal, the steel debris, to give that example, although when you look at it, it's extremely revealing. The question is, why are, say, you and I looking at it in conversation right now, and why don't millions and millions of people all over the place know about that? They don't know about it because the mainstream media have omitted it from the public record by and large, or where it's been referred to, it's been downplayed and explained away and generally muffled and confused and fragmented. So it's not that you can't find, if you dig into LexisNexis, it's not that you can't find reports in the New York Times, for instance, about what happened to that debris. But the thing is that the information has never been pulled together by the New York Times or any other mainstream medium, never been pulled together in a coherent way and presented to the public in a way that shows at all the huge significance of the way that debris was handled. So it does come back, it seems to me, to the media, in large part, whether it's the mainstream corporate media or whether it's the so-called alternative media that have been so thoroughly infiltrated by agents of the state. And that is why, which I also deal with in my book, you cannot depend on Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! Or The Nation or Zed Magazine or The Progressive or In These Times or all these other otherwise progressive media voices. They all stay away from 9/11 like the plague, and furthermore, they even attack those who want to raise questions about the anomalies and contradictions and absurdities of the official conspiracy theory of 9/11. So why would they do that? Why all of a sudden on this one issue, except it's not quite this one issue, it also applies to the assassination of JFK and MLK and RFK and Malcolm X. But anyway, why on the small number of issues, which can be characterized as being operations by the deep state, by the most powerful forces that benefit from war, why would these allegedly progressive alternative outlets be silent or worse? Well, it just can't be that suddenly they don't see through the eyes that let them see the wrongs about the Vietnam War or the Iraq War or the Afghan War or corporate malfeasance and so on. I mean, suddenly they don't have different eyes. It's that they are refusing to look at this evidence, the steel debris and all the other evidence you mentioned. And so that's not by coincidence. That is by plan. That is because the covert agents, there's so many of them and so deeply ensconced within these organizations that they are performing the job that Hitler did on the socialists and communists, the conscious left of Germany in the 1930s. That is what's happening as we speak. It's an ongoing widespread distortion of society, and all we can do is try to make ourselves aware of this and not be afraid to speak up about it. But if the media, corporate or so-called alternative, it would really only take one true breakthrough in the media in order to seriously change the complexion of what we're looking at. You have to ask what would be a breakthrough. And from time to time, there are stories that appear in even a mainstream medium, maybe a daily newspaper in the Midwest of the USA or something like that, that actually publishes a story, could even once in a blue moon be on the front page, which is non-hostile toward some person or some organization that is questioning the official story of 9/11. And that rapidly comes to the attention through the internet of those of us who are very concerned in this area. And some people will call it a breakthrough. I've seen that repeatedly. Breakthrough, breakthrough. No, no. What a breakthrough would be, would have to be, at the very minimum, would be what happened with Watergate, in which case you'll recall that the Washington Post reporters were in touch with Deep Throat about the wrongs of the Watergate burglary and reaching up to the Nixon White House, and they started to report this. And that's even in such a prestigious journal as the Washington Post. And even then, other media didn't pick it up right now. Noticeably, the New York Times. And what the Washington Post did was it stuck with it. And day after day after day, it kept revealing more and more and more, and hammering at it and playing it up. And hammering at it and playing it up. Then New York Times had to take notice and did a belated job of catch-up. The New York Times reporters can tell you stories about that, because Seymour Hersh was one of them. They were in a panic. There, suddenly, New York Times sent people to Washington and said, we got to start to match the Post. And then once the Times and the Post were both on it, then other papers joined, and then it became a crescendo, and it resulted finally in the resignation of Nixon. But that's what a breakthrough is. And regrettably, when we look back on that, it wasn't just a shining example of media democracy. It turns out that Bob Woodward himself had been a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence from a young age, and that there were interior tensions within the deep state, and there were people who wanted Nixon out, and that's why it was done.
That's exactly so, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but nevertheless, Watergate, the way the Washington Post dealt with Watergate, nevertheless, even with that huge blemish, stands as an example of what fairly could be called a breakthrough. And so until we see that, then there's nothing has been done that deserves the title breakthrough.
Well, I don't disagree with your characterization of what a breakthrough really would be, and the type of sea change that happened with the Washington Post's coverage of Watergate. But I suppose that my take on it would be that the 9/11 truth movement, and in fact people waiting for any type of breakthrough on any issue, maybe the point should not be to be waiting for the breakthrough to happen. But I think the point is, as you mentioned, as soon as these types of miniature breakthroughs or things that people want to characterize as breakthroughs happen, they spread instantaneously to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of people around the world through the internet and through the grassroots citizen media, which I really do believe is replacing the establishment media in the hearts and minds of the people who recognize that the establishment media is an ongoing part of the cover-up, and the alternative media as well will not question certain events or talk about certain pieces of evidence. So I think building that grassroots internet journalism movement is more important at this point than waiting for a breakthrough in the establishment or even the alternative press.
Oh, I would agree with you 100%. And if anything I said would suggest that I agree with waiting, waiting for somebody else, waiting for some hero to come to the rescue, waiting for some institution, especially of all institutions, the media, to pull our wagon for us. No, no, we can't. It won't happen. It won't happen. And so it's up to it's the responsibility of each person insofar, so referring back to the earlier part of the conversation. We have responsibility that equates with our degree of knowledge. And when we have the knowledge of a wrong, then with that comes the responsibility to try to right that wrong. And I believe that there are marvelous quotations that are far more persuasive than my putting it that way. I believe Martin Luther King Jr. Said regarding the Vietnam War that there come in, I believe it was during his famous talk at Riverside Church in New York City, almost exactly 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. He said, "There comes a time when silence is complicity." And what he meant was silence by people who know that the barbarous things are happening in Vietnam, but who are not speaking up, are not taking action. And it could be said that that was a big reason, if not the main reason, that his life was taken, because he was speaking up not only on behalf of blacks who had been suppressed through mainly white on black racism, but also then he had taken up the cause of the poor in general, of all colors. So he had put himself against the racist elements of U.S. society, and then he had put himself against the economic powers of U.S. society. And finally, when he linked that third major issue of the Vietnam War, the wrongness of it, against the military machine, that's when he really came into the crosshairs, and they said, this guy can't be allowed to live any longer. He's too dangerous. And because he was connecting three very large dots. And but anyway, to go back, it's true, we hadn't discussed the internet, and it's changed the picture of human communications in a revolutionary way. And it's still evolving, of course. And it's breaking out in many directions. The relative decline of the mainstream media is something that I cannot help but be happy about. I mean, I have mixed feelings, having been a member of the media all my life, but because of the overarching deceptions and wrongs. Multiple major wrongs in the world, gaps in income, and illegitimate wars, and so forth. They're interrelated. They're interrelated with the economic system, with Wall Street, and global monopoly capitalism, and so on. So there are still these very large dots. I think that I'll retract that. But there's a growing number of people who are doing in their own minds what Martin Luther King did, which is to connect those three big dots, poverty, racism, and war. And so insofar as that understanding comes that they're interrelated and that there needs to be a pushback on every conceivable front in order to depose those forces of death and injustice and war, that then it could be said that there's almost a spiritual dimension to the maturation of humankind. This may be and probably is really wishful thinking on my part, but it's one possible way to look at the situation. And it may be that the situation is hopeless. I mean, that has to be faced in individual lives. Sometimes we come to the end of our life. We've got, it's game over. There's no point in pretending it isn't. This can happen with institutions, can happen with families, and can happen with the human experiment overall. And frankly, I'm not optimistic on that front. There's so much that we know now about how our nervous systems work, and it doesn't appear that we're actually wired for survival. But nevertheless, you never know your luck, and it could be that there will be some seed change, some great transformation, and that we may, it's not just to dodge a bullet. We've got a whole hail of bullets we have to dodge if we're to if humankind is to emerge relatively unscathed. We're not going to emerge unscathed because we've already scathed so much of the planet environmentally and from the point of view of, you know, social injustice and so forth. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't look like there's any real, really great happy ending in store for humankind. But at least we should do what we can to be graceful under pressure and to try to ameliorate the worst of our human tendencies. And it was H.G. Wells who said, very tellingly, history is a race between education and catastrophe. And probably, as the saying goes, that's never been truer than today.
Well, absolutely, that is true. And as much as I may disagree with some of H.G. Wells' ideology, that statement does hold true. And you say that there are quotations that more accurately persuade people about our position. But I think that what you just said there in totality was absolutely a solemn assessment, but a fair one. And I think ultimately, it does come down to the fact that we are opposed to the forces of death and all of the ways in which they are arrayed against the human experiment. And it's hard to imagine how anyone proclaiming to be arrayed against those forces could, in fact, support the transparent fraud that we've been exposed to with false flag operations like 9/11. And yet, as you've pointed out, that is something that, in fact, has occurred with the anti-war movement and the way it has, to a large extent, shunned the 9/11 truth movement. And I know this is something that you've written about recently and a conversation that you've been trying to open up on that front. So could you tell us a little bit more about that conversation?
Yes. I hope it's a conversation, and it's story, the narrative trajectory, if you will, of it, is that in late January, an anti-war strategy planning conference was scheduled to be held at MIT in Boston by an organization called New England United, which is a consortium of affiliated peace and social justice organizations. And I don't know how many there are, but it must be 60 or 70. It's a very, very broad-based federation. And so the Greater Boston 9/11 Truth Alliance, which had been trying to gain a presence at the table of the New England United, call it NEU, for some time and had failed, saw this this conference of the 30th of January to be perhaps an opportunity to be allowed to join the other peace organizations, the other anti-war organizations, to have a voice at the conference. And this was resisted at almost every turn by the leaders of NEU. But through the persistence of some of the Boston 9/11 truth people, one in particular, it was possible to get a workshop into the afternoon. It was a one-day conference, a workshop on 9/11, and there was to be a speaker, Peter Dale Scott, on that afternoon panel, one of three, I think, or four panelists who would address the deep state, which is, I guess, he's mainly known for his work on the deep state. And then it turned out that Peter Dale Scott, relatively at the last minute, could not make it to Boston because his wife fell quite ill. And there was a question as to whether there could be a Skype video link established, something that you and I failed to establish this morning, by the way. Anyway, whether there could be this this Skype video link established so that Peter Dale Scott could address the NEU conference that way. And they had to decide, if that failed technologically, that there would be a backup person to take Peter Dale Scott's place. And I was put forward as that person. And I tried to prepare in case I was called upon to do that. And as it turned out, the technical connection was made quite well. The line failed once and was rapidly restored. So Peter Dale Scott was able to address the New England United Anti-War Strategy Planning Conference. And during it, by the way, he specifically mentioned the presence of covert agents in the anti-war movement, even so far as to say, the agents who are no doubt among you today as I speak. Interestingly, no one chose to pick up that theme from what Peter Dale Scott said. But meanwhile, I was being vilified rejected by some of the leaders of NEU as being an appropriate fill-in for PDL Scott. The reason given why I would be an extremely inappropriate fill-in for Peter Dale Scott was because of my association with the 9/11 Truth Movement. And these leaders are viciously opposed to 9/11 Truth. And so various barbs were thrown in my direction, a lot of guilt by association, claiming, among other things, and this is actually laugh out loud, that I'm an extreme right-winger. I mean, anybody who's been listening to this conversation, if they could figure out how I'm an extreme right-winger, I'd like to know how that gets figured out. And then that I'm a LaRoucheite. And this is because of my alleged guilt by association with Webster Tarpley. And I'm not very closely associated with Webster. We've shared a stage, and I admire his work. I know he was a LaRouche person. He was central in the LaRouche organization. I'm not ready to write off Webster Tarpley because he was. I wouldn't write off somebody who was a member of the Nazi Party because they were. You've got to decide each case on its merits. So anyway, a lot of bad mouthing of me. But when the conference ended, and then the next day there was the conference of the Greater Boston 9/11 Truth Alliance. After there was an 8-hour drive back from Boston to Buffalo, where I caught a bus for Toronto, and I got to thinking, I should write a report on these two conferences. And it had become so obvious about the bad blood, if you will, between the leaders of New England United, who were involved in organizing that conference, and 9/11 Truth and 9/11 Truthers, and the hostility was all one way. It wasn't Truthers bad mouthing the New England United. Far from it. There were probably 60 or 70 Truthers there, and they didn't shout. They didn't do anything that was uncivil or undemocratic. What was happening was that the Truthers were being rejected by the other anti-war people, especially their leaders, and as had been happening for 8 years. And so I wrote a report on the two conferences pointing this out, simply pointing out that the reason for the alleged split between the peace movement on the one side, if you will, and the 9/11 Truth Movement on the other side, if you will, was because of rejection, initial rejection, and the maintenance of that rejection from the so-called peace or anti-war side all along, and that these two conferences were just an example. And for that, I wrote my report. I thought, that's got to be said. It's so obvious, and it's so important, and if we're to come together, we have to clarify this. Now, one of the clarifications I came to And again, this comes under the heading of how the heck could I have been asleep for so long and not have clarified this in my own mind? One of the reasons was the terminology that we've been using. We talk about the anti-war movement or the peace movement. That's pretty well synonymous. Those two terms are interchangeable. Then we talk about the 9/11 truth movement. And I've been as guilty of anyone of using these terms. I didn't realize it was something to feel guilty about, but it is, because I would contend, and I don't think that there could be very serious argument against this, that members of the 9/11 truth movement are as thoroughly and proudly and effectively anti-war as anybody in any other anti-war organization. So in other words, let's stick with the word peace. So there's a peace movement, and in the peace movement are various organizations with different names. And one of the movements within the movement is the 9/11 Truth Movement. It's absolutely a peace movement. There's a president of the what used to be called Veterans for 9/11 Truth, which now has been renamed Veterans for 9/11 Truth, Justice, and Peace. That's a more accurate labeling. And so there's the peace movement includes the 9/11 Truth Movement, which emphasizes the importance of truth first. And then there are other organizations belong to the peace movement that for some reason have different emphases. They want to emphasize generalities about the war machine or whatever. And I'm not putting them down. But what so many of them have in common is that they will not accept or adopt 9/11 truth as being a necessary and important plank in any peace organization's platform. It should be anyway. And when you ask why it isn't, then you come back to this question of agents of the state again, left gatekeepers who control the opposition, and there's a lot of them. But you get into hot water by mentioning it. I think we have to get into this hot water, because we'll be in even hotter water if we don't deal with it. So I wrote this report, and it really set off a bit of a firestorm, and it's too complicated to go into what happened, but there was a subsequent post NEU anti-war conference meeting, and it got very heated, and at least one member of the Boston 9/11 Truth Alliance decided that I needed to be repudiated because I had raised the issue of agents of the state. And of course, my first report wasn't perfect, and I wrote it fairly quickly. I'm not trying to get out of any responsibility for a single comma in there, just because I had to write it quickly, decided to write it quickly, thought it needed to be written quickly. But anyway, sure, it was imperfect. And the imperfections, some of them gave openings to those who wanted to thoroughly vilify me. So what I've done, and I just have finished the creation of it just last night, it's been a long time I've been working on this, is a fairly extensive document in which I reach out, if you will, the olive branch toward everyone who is for peace, and I attempt to clarify these terms. I hope people will see that it's important to do so. And then I do go into the question of agents of the state and point out that it's an ongoing issue, that it's a mistake not to look at. In other words, if we don't look at it, we become complicit. Interestingly, the agents, and I'm not naming any names, of course, but it can be discussed generically, the agents are in a win-win situation. If the issue of agents within peace organizations is raised, it does cause dissension, if you will. It certainly causes debate. It can cause heated debate. It can lead to repudiation, can lead to expulsion. There's going to be a meeting on April the 17th of NEU. I understand there'll be a motion to expel Boston, Greater Boston 9/11 Truth from the organization. This is extremism to get into expulsions. It's the opposite of agreeing to disagree and generally approaching things in a civil way. But anyway, the issue I think needs to be discussed. The agents, if it is discussed, there's a lot of argument that can take place and should take place, and that argument can be used, can get out of control by people of goodwill. They might get into name calling, guilt by association, expulsion, all sorts of stuff like that. So in which case the goals of the agents to destabilize and weaken the anti-war or peace movement are met. On the other hand, if the issue isn't raised about agents and it doesn't get discussed, their goals are also met because they can proceed to do their dirty work without being called on it, without it being discussed. So they're in a favorable position. But I think that's all the more reason why we should discuss that very fact in as rational and calm a way as we can, bringing evidence to the table and bringing goodwill to the table and bringing a democratic discourse to the table. So that's what my new report says.
Well, that's right. And the idea that the agents of the state operating inside the peace movement could be a point of contention would be laughable if it wasn't so easily demonstrable as just a plain fact, and it's just so obvious that in fact we can look into the way that the Maryland State Police has actively spied on peace groups, or the way that the Fresno Police Department has actively spied on peace groups, or the way the U.S. military has been found spying on peace groups across the country, the way the FBI has been found spying on peace groups across the country, and all of these examples coming within the last decade, and then thinking about the greater history of the way that the FBI and other agencies of the United States government has openly spied on various groups and planted informants within groups to sow dissension through things like the COINTELPRO operation. We've seen, even in the case of things like the creation of domestic terror cells in the United States, and it comes out in case after case after case after case that it was in many cases founded and stirred up by FBI informants and people on that side. So to think that there are not active agents of the state operating with inside the peace movement would be not only naive, but I think absolutely ludicrous to think that that's not the case. So to think that that's actually a point of contention is almost unthinkable.
I agree. It's another aspect of the vastness of the cover-up that comes under the heading almost unthinkable, as you say. And but we're fortunate, those of us who are concerned about this and are willing to raise it, that there is the evidence, as you mentioned. And I did include one in my statement, which, by the way, I sent to you, but not for redistribution. I hope you haven't redistributed it, because it's not just a draft, but it's only been sent to the Boston Truth Organization, and I need to get their feedback and to fix it, you know, and create another draft, improve it, and then I will have it, I hope, distributed much more widely to the New England peace movement as a whole, if you will, and possibly post it other places. And we're talking about it, but I'm not ready. I haven't got the version that has the blessing of the Greater Boston 9/11 Peace Alliance yet, and I'm hoping that maybe within a week they will have been seeing it and willing to look at it and have provided their feedback, their criticisms, and then I'll amend it, and then it'll be ready for wider distribution. I did include as one of the appendices, there are six of them, the text of an article by Amy Goodman. The article is headed, "Obama's Military is Spying on U.S. Peace Groups." And that appeared on the Huffington Post on July the 28th last year. So I did include a little bit of that evidence that you referred to, James, for the recipients of this piece to look at. And as you say, much more could be brought to that table.
It certainly could. All right. So your original piece that started this discussion was published on 911blogger.com. Do you imagine that's where this piece might be ending up when it's ready for public distribution?
I hope so. I'm pretty sure, because of the care that I'm trying to apply to this, although it's quite long, but because it involves 9/11 so deeply, 9/11 truth, shall we say, and because it also involves the this intersection between the 9/11 truth peace movement and the rest of the peace movement, which was of great interest to people who read my original post. I think there were about 80 people chimed in. So I think that continues to be of interest to 9/11 truthers for sure. And I've lost my password, but once I find my password, I'll offer after it's been commented upon by the Boston Truth people, I feel a big responsibility toward them. Partly, I've put them in the hot water by my original report. I do feel a responsibility in that connection, and so I want them to have a chance to have a go at this, and then at some point, I would hope to post it, to offer it to 9/11 blogger to be posted, and I'm guessing that they'll accept it.
All right. Well, stepping back for a moment just to take a look at what we're discussing, I guess to me what this indicates is really the disconnect that happens between these large institutional organizational structures that deem to speak for a large movement of people and the people themselves. And I think one very clear instance of that came at the end of March of this year, in which We Are Change LA, I believe it was, participated in a large anti-war demonstration and persisted in the face of opposition from some of the leaders of that protest, but in fact garnered a lot of support from the people who were actually there. For people who may not have seen that video, which has been making the rounds on YouTube, could you describe a little bit about what happened there and what that really indicates for what we're talking about?
Yes. Well, I thought that as a truther, I was very buoyed by what We Are Change LA did, and there was to be a peace march in LA. It was March 28th, and so We Are Change LA, which is very much focused on getting the truth about 9/11 out as the most significant single step that could be taken to push back against the deep state and the hyper militarization that's going on and so on, that they wanted to be a part of this parade, this march, and so they had already received negative signals from the organizers of the march. The institutional, almost the official unofficial peace movement, and but they the We Are Change LA people proudly said we want to be a big part of this march, and they created extremely large and very attractive, well done banners. They were white on blue. And they said things like 9/11 is the key to peace, sentiments like that. And then they also had the smaller placards about 9/11 truth that could be stapled to the back of peace placards that said other things, like "We want peace now" and so forth. And so then they wanted to have a place at or near the front of this parade. And this is where the problems arose between the organizers of the parade and the We Are Change LA people. And as they reported, as the We Are Change LA people reported in some text that you can find that's posted on the same page as that wonderful video, it's very well done. They said right off the bat, I'm quoting here, a young representative from the local chapter of ANSWER, the organization that organized this anti-war demonstration, approached us and told us that we would have to take our banners to the back of the march. And so it's almost like, you know, to the back of the bus. It sort of has a resonance with racism. And then they mentioned that Bruno Brewiler, who's with We Are Change LA, immediately confronted this young representative who was trying to kick us to the back of the bus, as he says. And he said, the organizer, ANSWER has permit for the march, and they can tell us what to do. So now I would add this comment to this report, that you have an anti-democratic impulse. You have a tyrannical approach. We can tell you what to do. This is not the way of democracy. This is not discourse, not conversation, not respectful exchange. This is somebody who is saying that I will give orders. And so that, to me, is not consonant with the path to peace. And so he said, ANSWER has the permit. They can tell us what to do. Bruno reminded him, I'm quoting now again, that they do not have a permit to trespass on our freedom of speech, and went on to advise the young man to go back and tell his team that if they do not want to incur the liability for trespassing our First Amendment rights, he said they don't want to incur the liability for trespassing on our First Amendment rights. The young man walked away after warning us that we would have to deal with the police. And that's the way it went. But the fact is that that the 9/11, the We Are Change LA people took their place in the parade, and nothing happened that would be negative. The We Are Change LA people have very good relations with the police. As they say, they love the police and the police love them because they're law-abiding and they're respectful, they're civil. They're even, you know, properly dressed and groomed. They are really upstanding citizens of the finest kind. And so there was no hassle. It turned out that there were no false flag agents around to toss bricks through windows or anything on this particular occasion, which often happens, by the way. And so they were up front. And because 9/11 truth had such a prominent place, not only in the parade, but right at the front of it, the parade was stronger, it was more effective, it was larger, and it was more diverse. And nothing bad came of it. And so this shows that that 9/11 truth people, who are members of the peace movement, can be welcomed among other members of the peace movement, whatever their focus, and all can march together, literally and figuratively.
Well, that is a very positive note to leave things on, as I think we're drawing to the end of our time today, and I'm not sure there's an adequate way to summarize this type of conversation or to draw all of these threads together. We've obviously talked about a wide range of subjects, but I would like to direct people, obviously, to your work and so that they can begin to explore these subjects on a deeper level. And of course, I would recommend your books, such as Tower of Deception, the media cover-up of 9/11, which obviously touches on a great deal of the subjects we're talking about today, and also some of your articles and things which obviously relating to 9/11 have been published on 911blogger.com. Are there any other places that you would like to direct people to go to get more information about your own work?
Well, I've been associated for a long time with Global Outlook magazine, and it can be found on the net at www.globaloutlook.ca. The most recent issue of Global Outlook, regrettably, is its last, unless there's some financial miracle occurs. It was issue number 13. So Global Outlook was published, I believe the first issue came out around January or so of 2002. It was around the time that my appearances on national television here in Canada, Seriously Questioning, the official story about 9/11 came out. We sort of launched around the same time. And I have been a contributing editor from the beginning. And so if a person goes to that website, globaloutlook.ca, then there's back issues available, and there's just a wealth of information in them. The Global Outlook does connect those dots, for instance, of the economy, along with the deep state and the truth about 9/11. But it's been known as the magazine of 9/11 truth. That has been where most of the pages have been devoted to 9/11 truth. And it's extremely well put together. My dear friend and colleague, Ian Woods, has been the publisher all along. And he's had to move back into real estate so that he can just earn a living. This is we don't receive any funding from the state, unlike all those covert agents and members of the media do. So that's one place I'd suggest. As far as my book is concerned, Towers of Deception, it still is selling, and I like to sell it personally right out of my home here. And the phone number is 416-651-5588, 416-651-5588. And so people can actually phone me. I love to meet people on the phone, and then I can fulfill orders for Towers of Deception. In Towers of Deception, I'll just briefly describe it. It's 416 pages. It has more than 100 illustrations, and it includes my DVD, The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. And there isn't that much overlap between the DVD and the book, by the way, less than 10%, I'd say. And so I sell the book it depends on the country and so forth, but mostly for $25 Canadian, which is very similar to $25 U.S. these days. The Canadian and U.S. dollars are almost at par. And then there's a shipping and handling cost. So that's my stuff. I'm working on the book, as I say, on false flag operations. The working title is False Flag Operations, History's Deadliest Deceits and Why They Matter. And it'll have 8 chapters. And I'm hoping that it will appear next year, the year of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. There's going to be a lot of books come out between now and then, and probably especially then, which will be part of the propaganda onslaught that was discussed way back at the beginning. And so I'm just hoping to make a contribution, not to the onslaught, but against the onslaught.
Absolutely. Well, I very much look forward to that contribution, as I'm sure many of my listeners do as well. And all we can do is to try to continue fighting back against the propaganda onslaught, obviously, as independent citizens not funded by the state who are just trying to make whatever difference we can and to contribute to the conversation like what we're doing today. So, Barry Zwicker, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I want to thank you for your generous donation of your time today.
Well, it was a pleasure, as I knew it would be, and also it's important to point out the tremendous work that you do on the Corbett Report. I much admire your website. I'm sorry that we couldn't get our Skype connection working today, so it would be an audio-video thing, but I'm very impressed. The work that you've done on whistleblowers alone is just tremendous, and obviously it's a subject that I'll be looking at it in my book. So I salute you for your ongoing wonderful work, James.
Well, thank you very much, and please take care, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future.
Yes, I do too. Take care.